Hey friends, welcome back to the High Functioning Disaster. I'm your host, Sasha Holder. And yes, this one is dropping more than a week late. Life was lifing, and around here we practice what we preach. Show up imperfectly, keep it honest, and keep going. Thanks for sticking with me. Today we're picking up part two of my conversation with Angie Hawkins, author of Running in Slippers and creator of the Shine From the Inside program. If you missed part one, Angie shared her journey from rock bottom to radical self-love. In this part, we get practical. Writing your own rules for life and choosing loyalty to self. Moving from external validation to internal confidence. Real-world boundary scripts and why enforcing them is the work. Reframing nerves into momentum. Hello, Carly and Bruce story. A simple 90-second anxiety reset you can try tonight, and using big scary adventures to build everyday courage, especially the courage to be seen. Quick note, this episode includes candid mentions of anxiety and panic. All right, let's jump back in where we left off. So what is the one thing, maybe two things, that really keeps you showing up and sharing who you are, continuing to let people see you, to be vulnerable to the public?
It's mostly because in my coaching business, I guide women through the same journey that I went through, because I was high achieving, over functioning, not feeling happy and fulfilled. So I help women see their internal worth and stop chasing and performing for outside of themselves so they can feel happy and fulfilled. And so, I mean, I'm still growing and changing every day. And every day I will notice something where I'm responding better than I used to, or making better decisions than I used to. And I just feel a huge sense of pride for how far I've come. And also just, again, like I actually feel happy and fulfilled now, no matter what is going on in my life. Whereas before, I was like struggling to keep it all together and had the facade that everything was fine. But I was unhappy, unfulfilled. I felt like I was falling apart every day. I used to have extreme anxiety. I barely have anxiety anymore. So just the changes that I have seen and felt in myself, I'm so eager to share that with the world. So that's the main thing that keeps me going, because it's like, I want to help as many people as I can.
I love that. It's incredibly, well, it's very opposite of kind of what we're taught when we're growing up, that we're supposed to aspire to be successful. And successful looks like this. It's this box, and you have to check it to be successful. And really, it's whatever lights your fire and gives you that sense of purpose. And yeah. I think a lot of us go into corporate America and we're able to check the boxes that for the things, the actual material, physical things that we can get with the income that we can make. But if it's not bringing pure joy and satisfaction, then what purpose does it serve aside from, I mean, of course, like I said, you do have to make money and pay your bills if you don't want to be homeless, but there are other things that people can do that are more fulfilling, that speak to their sense of purpose and still pay the bills.
Yes. One of the most important things I learned in my healing journey was to make my own rules for life. Because, like, to your point, society or family systems has all these rules, but who came up with those? Like, they're just so seemingly arbitrary, and we all blindly follow them. Like, yep, this is what you're supposed to do. And following those rules made me miserable. So now I have my own rules for life. Like, for example, my overarching rule is that I'm loyal to myself. Some of my other rules are I don't sweep things under the rug. I speak my truth. I'm authentic. And as long as I'm living according to my own rules, then I'm living in integrity and I don't really care what society says.
Yeah, I love that. As long as you're living within your own rules, you're living in integrity. And I think that that's super important because I think so many of us can just jump through the hoops that are in front of us without thinking about what does it cost us. And sometimes those hoops cost us integrity.
Yeah.
And that's not good.
No, it really wears away at your mental health. And the worst part is it sneaks up on you because that's how corporate America was for me. I didn't realize how bad it was affecting my mental health until the end.
And that's really important because sometimes you're just trying to survive, particularly when you're in survival mode is what I'm trying to say. That is a good point because if you're just trying to survive, you miss so many things, red flags that you need to really be seeing for things that aren't good for you and be able to make a different plan or pivot so that you aren't more hurt or damaged in the long run. And when you're in survival mode, you just don't because you just want to make it through the day.
Yeah, I think a lot of people live that way, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's definitely, definitely difficult. So you help other women.
Yes.
To reclaim their light. So how do you help them shift from chasing external validation to cultivating inner confidence?
So my Shine From The Inside program, the whole basis is about, because I feel like a lot of self-help is marketed as fixing yourself or changing yourself. But the truth is we're all born with this light inside of us. But again, society has these rules and expectations. So as you go through life, that light slowly gets dimmed because you're repressing who you really are to fit into society or whatever situation you're in. And Shine From The Inside is all it is. It's rekindling that light and remembering who you are. So I have, it's called the Glow Method is the process that I take them through. But basically you go back to your childhood because a lot of our survival strategies, they're based upon our behaviors from when we were a child or teenager, and they're no longer serving us as adults. So we just figure out why we're doing the things we're doing and rekindle that light. And the biggest part about the whole program is actually integrating that into your day-to-day life. Because one of the reasons talk therapy never worked for me is because I would go to my therapist's office and we would talk for an hour and then I would leave. And it's kind of like, okay, what do I do with this information? Because it made sense and it felt good in the moment. Or like a lot of spiritual modalities, like if you go to a sound bath or whatever, it feels good in the moment, but then how do you actually put that into practice in your day-to-day life? So a huge part of what I do with women is like, for example, one of the main pillars in my program is boundaries because that is like the highest form of self-respect. So I teach women boundaries, but it's like those are things that you can implement in your everyday life. And it does take time to do the scarier boundaries, but there are, if you are starting from a place of no boundaries, there are many quick wins that you can do immediately to help build confidence. So it is a 6-month program, but like within the first month, you're already going to start to see changes because there's just so many things that you can do immediately to integrate into your life that will start build that confidence.
What sort of tips do you give the women that you help about setting boundaries? Because when you set boundaries, the people who disrespect them the most get pissed off, right?
Yeah.
And that's really, really difficult, even if it's something small. Like it could be like not one of the really big boundaries, but you know, you made a boundary and they don't like that you're standing up for yourself. And so they get pissed off. What kind of encouragement or tips do you give them?
Well, the first tip that I give is, and you basically just explain this, the hardest part of setting boundaries is not setting them, it's enforcing them. Because to your point, there are a lot of people that don't like to hear the word no. And it is hard. I'm not going to lie. It's hard at first because you do feel guilty. You do feel the need to over-explain. But this is the biggest tip that I give people because this helped with me. Think of a celebrity who's known for being a diva. Like I always think of Mariah Carey. But it's like, so say you're inviting me. I know it's virtual, but say you're like inviting me to some virtual event and I say no. And then you keep like pressuring me or, you know, whatever tactic people use. And, but like someone like Mariah Carey wouldn't feel guilty. She wouldn't be over explaining. She values her time. She knows she's not available or she knows she's, it's not something that she's interested in. So you need to have that same level of confidence. Like, no, my time is precious. Like I need that, you know, maybe my reason for saying no is that I need to rest and fill my own cup. You don't need to explain that to the person. That's just your own value. So you stick firm to it. And again, I know I feel like I'm oversimplifying it, but that I feel like that's a good tip because at first you do feel guilt and you do feel the need to over-explain. And honestly, and I know some people don't want to hear this, you have to learn to sit in that discomfort. That's one way to get over it. But another helpful tip is just like be the diva. There's a reason why people act like that. It's because they value their own time and energy so much that they don't settle for anything less.
Yes. And I like that you use the example of a celebrity, because if you think about particularly the celebrities who are like A-listers, right? Yeah. They are constantly in the spotlight and they don't usually have a lot of private time. And so they want to protect that and therefore protect themselves from,
yeah,
you know, being always on. And being always on is so detrimental.
Yeah. So there's actually valid reasons that they're selective and they don't have to explain it, right? So you shouldn't have to explain yourself either.
Exactly. So my next question is, if a listener is stuck in burnout and people pleasing right now, what's one tiny first step they can take tonight to move forward to reclaiming their light?
Honestly, I would say boundaries because, and again, if you're starting from a place of zero boundaries, the example that I just used of simply saying no when someone invites you to do something, you would be shocked. Like, even if they do push back a little bit and you do have a little bit of guilt, or maybe you actually do over explain, but just the fact that you said no, that's going to make you feel good, especially if the reason is because you want to fill your cup. And then you, instead of doing the thing, you actually fill your cup and you realize, first of all, you had the confidence to say no, then you actually got to fill your cup. And then you're like, oh, that felt good. And it gives you motivation to do it again. And that's why I love using boundaries, because again, that's the highest form of self-respect. And that's what helped me learn to love and respect myself. But also just like, yeah, like the confidence boost. And it's something you can easily, it's simple, it's not easy to implement in everyday life. And once you say no a few times, then you can say no to your family or like, you know, make the harder step and gradually move up. Because for me, I actually started with boundaries in the workplace, which at first was terrifying. But then once I realized like, oh, I'm not getting pulled in a gazillion different directions and or this situation is working out better, that gave me motivation to do it again. And not only that, I actually started getting feedback from coworkers like, oh, you have such good boundaries around your time. And so even just getting that positive reinforcement was motivating. So boundaries are something that are simple, although not always easy to implement in everyday life. And you can really get that momentum and motivation and confidence going immediately.
So the company I used to work for contracted with BetterUp, and we could get a coach through BetterUp. And then they have different little webinars that you could go to that are like 25 minutes long. And one was on the art of saying no. And I was like, what is this? You can say no. And so I did go to it. And because in my brain, I'm a Gen Xer, and I'm like, you don't say no at work.
Yeah.
They give you a task and you say, sure, let me get that done. And if I'm overwhelmed, I'll just figure out how to fit it in. And so after it, my mind was blown because I'm like, this totally makes sense. Why did I not think of this before? And I took a little like post-it note. It wasn't sticky, but like that size. And I wrote on it, exercise your right to say no, or your ability, exercise your ability to say no. And I stuck it on my laptop.
And it worked, whenever, right?
Yes, it absolutely did. And like mind blowing to see it, like that's not something I want to do. Or maybe it's something I want to do, but I don't really have the bandwidth. And so then I became able, more willing, instead of just being like, oh gosh, I got to take this on, but more willing to say, hey, I would love to do that, but I don't have the bandwidth. So I'm going to have to give up something else. So in particular, like with your manager, when your manager brings a new task for you to do, okay, I don't really have the bandwidth for this. So I'm going to have to give something else up if I'm going to take this. So then you're open for negotiation. You're not walled off to like, no, I can't take anything, but here's what I can do. And I think people are more reciprocal and open to negotiations than just flat out no. But I'm not saying that when there's a boundary that you need to set where the absolute no has to be there, that you shouldn't do that because you should.
Yeah. And that's actually a really good example. And also, I did oversimplify the no, because also this is another thing I tell people. Yeah, because at work, like, it's professional. So you're not just going to tell your manager, nope, I'm not doing this. Like, you're open to the conversation and negotiation. Also, I tell people, like with friends and family, even though you don't need to explain yourself, like you can give a little blurb like, no, I need time to rest or whatever, because it does sound kind of harsh when you're just like, no, I'm not going, or I'm not doing that. So it doesn't have to be like all cut and dry, like I probably explained it. So that was a really good example.
Yeah, no, I didn't think that you made it cut and dry at all.
Okay.
I think that you did well to explain that. But I appreciate you circling back there just in case it came through that way for someone else. So living boldly, your adventures, you're very adventurous. So you moved to Hawaii on your own. You've been skydiving, cliff jumping, and that contrasts with your fear of vulnerability. So you've jumped out of helicopters.
Yes.
Like Navy SEAL style, but you say vulnerability still scares you more. Why is that?
Well, I think it's more the fear of allowing myself to be seen, which is vulnerability. Well, just to be clear, I don't identify as adventurous. The reason I do those things is to intentionally get out of my comfort zone. And that in turn helps me with allowing myself to be seen, because for instance, going back to the example of making video content for Instagram, because it seems ridiculous, like there's no excuse I can have for not doing it, because it's like, okay, I've bungee jumped, I've jumped out of a helicopter, and I'm too afraid to make a stupid video for Instagram. So that's why I like doing those things. It's because it gets me so out of my comfort zone that any excuse for something less just doesn't even exist anymore.
That's wild. I am absolutely terrified to do any of that. I don't have any safety. I'll go on a roller coaster. I'll fly in a plane, but I don't want to jump out of one.
So I went skydiving after bungee jumping, and bungee jumping is terrifying. So skydiving, I was like, oh, this is actually fun. Because skydiving, there's someone with you. So they have a vested interest in not killing both of you. Also, skydiving, there's wind resistance. So like bungee jumping is just a straight free fall. It would be like if you jumped out of a window and you're just falling. Whereas like with skydiving, there's actual wind resistance. So it doesn't feel like that straight falling that makes your stomach just sink.
Yeah, I would never would have thought that, but yeah, because the air moves and so it would press against you.
Oh yeah, like the video, like my skin is like, because I don't even really have loose skin, but in the video it looks loose because it's just like flapping in the wind because there's so much wind resistance.
Oh, that's funny. I don't know. I probably wouldn't go skydiving. Too afraid. What does courage look like for you now in everyday life compared to those big, bold leaps that you were making?
So courage to me, because I used to think courage meant not being afraid. But now I understand that courage means doing the thing despite being afraid.
Yeah. And, you know, I think of it that way, just doing it even though you're afraid. But you put a little different spin on that.
Wait, isn't that what I said? How is that different?
Oh, sorry. I maybe I heard it differently.
I just doing it despite being afraid.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
What did you think I said?
I thought you said that. Yeah, I don't know.
Or maybe I did say something different. Am I losing? I might. Sometimes I've been known to lose my mind.
Haven't we all?
Feeling the fear and doing it anyway.
Feeling the fear and doing it anyway. So yeah, okay. Like, I know I'm afraid, but like actually feeling it and getting in there and be like, okay, not just like, I'm afraid I'm not doing it. Would you say that you do that? Like you embrace the fear?
Yes. I don't let the fear stop me from doing anything anymore. Also, I have another thing to add to this.
Sure.
Do you know who Tony Robbins is?
I do.
I used to listen to him all the time. And I remember one time he told this story. And you will know who these people are. Sometimes I feel old saying this. But Carly Simon, the singer, she suffered from really bad stage fright. And one time someone asked her, you know, how does she know she's getting stage fright or what does stage fright feel to her? And she said, well, when I'm about to go on stage, my heart starts beating really fast. I get all sweaty, like my hands are shaking. And that's how I know I'm having an anxiety attack and can't perform. And then Bruce Springsteen, the singer, someone asked him, like, well, how do you get ready to go on stage? And he was like, before I go on stage, like my heart starts beating really fast. I start sweating. My hands start shaking. And that's how I know I'm so excited and ready to go out on stage. And Tony's point was, and he was the first person to point this out. I've heard it several times since, but fear and excitement, they have the exact same physiological responses in your body. The difference is the story that you tell yourself in your head. So Carly was telling herself, I'm scared and I can't do this. And Bruce was telling himself, like, oh, I'm excited. I'm ready to go. So I try to harness that energy because it's like, am I scared or am I excited? Also, because I've done so many scary things, I also know the like sense of pride afterwards. So I'm also kind of chasing that because it's like, okay, I know I'm going to be so proud of myself if I do this.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point because even if it's something you're afraid to do, to try, when you're done with it, even if you didn't like it, even if it wasn't for you, you still have that sense of pride of, man, I was afraid, but I tried it out anyway.
Yeah.
And even more so, how proud are you of yourself are you for trying something if you do like it?
Well, and I like that you add that dynamic into it because so many things that I've been afraid to do, after I do it, I'm like, whether I like it or not, I'm like, that wasn't even that bad. Like, because you build up this story like, oh, I'm not going to like it because it's going to be so scary. But it's like, it's almost like has a neutral effect. It's like whether you like it or don't like it, it doesn't even matter because it's like I did it and it wasn't even that scary.
Yeah. It's very interesting how we can talk ourselves out of things just because we feel nervous. And I think sometimes we can take that feeling of nerves and tell ourselves, like the analogy you gave of Bruce Springsteen and Carly Simon, how they are feeling similar things, but one was telling a negative story and one was telling a more positive story, that we can take that ball of nerves and give it a sort of negative personality of like, oh man, I'm afraid I can't do this, or boy, this is exciting and I'm ready to go kind of thing. You know, it's really interesting how our minds do that to ourselves. Like,
well, even I like where this is going, because I mentioned before, I used to suffer from really bad anxiety and I still do sometimes. It's not as bad as it was before, but something that helped with me, like, so if I get anxiety now, there's a trick that I learned. The physiological responses, like, so say an event happens, it gives me anxiety. The physiological response in my body to that anxiety only lasts 90 seconds. The reason why it lasts longer is because the story that you feed yourself. And so that's why it could last for like hours or days or weeks. So there's a trick where, so I get triggered by something, it causes me anxiety. All you have to do is just focus. Like, so I get a tight chest. So all I do is I put a hand on my stomach and a hand on my chest. So the hand on my stomach is so that I remember to breathe. And then I put a hand on my chest so that I focus on how my chest feels. And that's it. Like, I get rid of the story because I can deal with that later. But in the moment, I just breathe and focus on my chest and it goes away in 90 seconds. So that's just like adding on to how the stories can be so detrimental.
They can, absolutely. And I love that you brought this up because I have been anxious pretty much my entire life. Like, if I look back as being a child, there were times when I was definitely anxious, but I didn't have language for it. I think most children don't. But, you know, like in the 80s, we didn't talk about mental health, anxiety, depression, that kind of thing. But as a teenager, I developed panic attacks. And it was so terrifying to be in a panic attack because I felt like I couldn't breathe and I felt like I was going to die. And so the story that went in my brain is, what if I die? And then there's a snowball that happens from that. Well, what if I die? Then, oh my gosh, this is going to happen. Then that might happen. And then I got to a point where I was like, okay, but what if I don't die?
See? Yeah.
And that, I mean, that's helpful because it kind of stops that spiral in its tracks, right? So you can say, oh my gosh, what if I die? Or I feel like I'm going to die. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And if you can get just a little ounce of mindfulness and perspective and step back and see, okay, I'm having a panic attack, or maybe take that deep breath. Like, I tell my mom when she's anxious, breathe in through your nose, breathe in from your toes, and, you know, to try to help her get a big, deep breath. And if you can breathe, then you're probably okay. And that's going to help you settle down by doing those deep breaths. It helps kick in that parasympathetic nervous system to regulate your emotions and settle down.
And that reminds me of a story. So actually, I've been to the hospital a few times when I had an anxiety attack because I thought I was having a heart attack. And one time I was having an anxiety attack. I called 911 and I was talking to the operator and I don't even think he called an ambulance. He basically coached me on breathing. And then he was like, okay, now how do you feel? I was like, I feel good. He was like, yeah, you just had an anxiety attack. Wow. But it was embarrassing for me at the time, but I was like, oh, it was that easy, because I was like, oh my God, I'm dying. I'm having a heart attack. And he was like, just breathe. And then that's all I had to do was breathe.
Yeah. Isn't that cool though? How, you know, something as simple as changing the way you're breathing, the depth and the pace with which you're taking a breath, it can really just calm you down and bring you back to a center. And then this is a great example of not knowing what you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, breathing was also a huge lesson in my healing journey, because I used to not breathe at all, which was probably why I was anxious all the time.
That's all for today's episode of The High Functioning Disaster. Come back tomorrow, yes, on a Friday, for the final episode of my conversation with Angie Hawkins. We'll wrap things up with her biggest lessons on courage, healing, and what it really means to live in alignment after burnout. If this conversation hit home, remember you're not broken and you're not alone. If you or someone you love is struggling, you can call or text 988 in the U.S. for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. I'm Sasha Holder, and this is The High Functioning Disaster, where we keep it messy, honest, and human. I'll see you tomorrow for the conclusion of this powerful conversation with Angie. Oh, and one last thing. The content shared on The High Functioning Disaster is for informational and conversational purposes only and is not intended as professional, medical, or mental health advice. Everyone's situation is unique, and what we talk about here may not apply to your specific circumstances. Please do what's right for you and always consult with a qualified professional for medical, mental health, financial, or legal guidance. You take care of you, boo. See you next time.